Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. Today, the return of Scott Ritter. You know him as a weapons inspector, a Marine intelligence officer. He writes pretty prodigiously these days, and we catch up on three of his recent columns, talking about intelligence failures related to COVID-19, how the pandemic is exposing the hollowed-out American economy, and the limited elasticity that it has today. And Scott also gives us a brilliant summation of the current oil war that's nominally between Russia and Saudi Arabia, but he argues the real target is the United States, our increased oil production, and the fracking operations that have made the United States one of the largest oil producers in the world. I want to thank the people who made this podcast possible, including our Buckeye buddy, Carl Howard, Susan Gavet, Jim Garrison, and Brian Massey. You can join them as subscribers to this podcast. Just visit peterbcollins.com/signup. Scott Ritter returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today. He spent 12 years as a Marine intelligence officer, became a leading weapons inspector in Iraq, and has published widely on important topics for many years now.
People moving out, people moving in, why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, vote for me and I'll set you free.
Temptation's Ball of Confusion opens the podcast today, and certainly life is upside down for many people in the United States and across the world today. And Scott Ritter is a voice I really respect. He is a very well-informed investigator and opinionator, and he's been very busy lately, and today I've asked him to join us to talk about three recent posts that are related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Scott, as always, great to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And just a personal check-in, you live in upstate New York near Albany, and what's your situation there right now?
Well, fortunately, the greater Capital District, the area around Albany, has not felt the brunt of the coronavirus effects yet. We have, I think, 60 people in the total area that have been hospitalized by it. My family has not been impacted by the disease per se. We're like everybody else in the state of New York, under a very stringent lockdown, and we're observing it. We're trying to do our best to suppress the curve. So,
And what is your view of Governor Andrew Cuomo? I consider him to be a complex figure. I am critical of many of his policies, but I can hold two thoughts at the same time. And I feel that overall, he has managed this crisis well and been resolute, compassionate, fact-based, in sharp contrast to Donald Trump.
Look, Andrew Cuomo is a lifelong politician and, like every politician, doesn't do anything without sticking his political finger in the air. That being said, I think he has the best interests of the people of New York and in, from a larger perspective of the people of the United States in his heart as he moved forward on this extremely difficult problem. I haven't seen a misstep yet, and like you, I'm often critical of him as governor, but right now he has my absolute support, and I look to him to help manage the state of New York through this crisis.
Scott, in a recent post that was published at the American Conservative, you expose in detail a failure of intelligence, and you describe a set of agencies that I had never heard of before, subsets of the Defense Intelligence Agency, notably the National Center for Medical Intelligence. And before we talk about its role here, what's the history of this agency, and what is its defined mission?
Well, the history of the agency goes back. It's based at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and that was home to the U.S. Army's biological warfare program back in the 1950s. It later turned into something called USAMRIT, which is the Military Institute for Infectious Disease, something of that nature. That's when I first ran into them back in the late 1980s. One of their remits is to look out for the welfare of American military personnel who are deployed overseas. They are responsible for ensuring that military personnel aren't inadvertently exposed to diseases, and to make sure that they have the means to protect themselves from identified threats, and that they don't bring it back home and infect others. And when I was deploying to the Soviet Union as a weapons inspector, we were deploying into an area that was known for high numbers of exposure to tick-borne encephalitis, a very, very dangerous strain of it. Hundreds of people in the area were exposed every year. Dozens died. And the area that we were inspecting, the woods were just filled with ticks. I actually set a record one day doing a patrol around the perimeter and brought back 48 ticks on my body.
Wow.
It was a big deal. And so I worked very closely with USAMRIT, me and the other inspectors. First of all, trying to get a grip on the threat and then trying to come up with a way to deal with the threat. Ultimately, we brought in a vaccine from Austria. It was non-FDA approved, but the Austrian version of tick-borne encephalitis closely resembled that from the Soviet Union. So we got a waiver to do that. And we did the whole blood screening thing, et cetera. So that's where I became knowledgeable of them. And I ran into them again during the Gulf War and elsewhere. It's a very good agency, and they transitioned sometime in the 2000s when we went to this whole concept of centers. They renamed themselves the National Center for Medical Intelligence. Their job is, in addition to looking out for the welfare of American military personnel, they have a national job. They are the single agency responsible in the United States intelligence community for doing predictive, proactive intelligence work on pandemics, on epidemiology, on potential viral outbreaks. In 2009, they actually did a fantastic job because of their work. They were able to provide a 2-month heads up to American policymakers about the H1N1 pandemic. They said this is going to be a problem, and the United States had 2 months to wrap its head around the problem, to get prepared for it, so that we minimize the impact of H1N1 on the United States. It was a coup, an intelligence coup. Now, these things don't happen happenstance. When I say in an intelligence agency, and I talk about predictive work, proactive work, this isn't analytical work. Yes, these are doctors. These are epidemiologists, viral infection specialists and such. And they do a lot of laboratory work. They bring in a lot of material from abroad and they evaluate it. But they also have a responsibility for collecting that material and directing the collection of this material. That means that they can task the CIA. They can task various defense intelligence organizations. They can task the NSA. They can task the entire intelligence community to do proactive intelligence collection work to support their mission. That means they go around the world and they do sampling. That means that they have their radar up. They have people, you know, that are inside the Chinese Center for Disease Control, or they should have people inside the Chinese Center for Disease Control who are getting a heads up on these things. There's, you know, there was a big article in the Washington Post in March that was very critical of the president, and I'm very critical of the president. Many people are, but on this one, it said, you know, the intelligence community was telling them, was screaming at the top of their voices, this is going to be a problem in January and February, and the president didn't do anything. Well, yeah, the president in a presentation recently, sometime in March, he said it would have been nice to get a little bit of a heads up on this thing. And people said, but you were given a heads up. No. If you read the intelligence reports cited, they're from a time frame after the Chinese had published the totality of their holdings on COVID-19, after the Chinese had done the work, after the Chinese had identified this as a novel coronavirus, after the Chinese had broken the genetic code, interpreted the genomes, and ascertained that this was a human-to-human transaction. After this was done, the National Center for Medical Intelligence issues a report calling it a threat. That's not intelligence work. That's journalism of a very bad sort.
But let me ask this, because the context of the president's remarks about I wish we had had notice and kind of griping, I thought were aimed at the Chinese government. And he has apparently dialed back from calling it a Chinese virus and making those kinds of typical Twitter comments that he is infamous for. But was he really talking about a U.S. intelligence failure, or was he blaming the Chinese in a deflective move?
We could ask the president. I'll tell you this. The Chinese have no role to play in advising the executive branch of the United States government on matters pertaining to national security. So if the president was blaming this on China, he's double damned. The bottom line, though, is that there is an organization in the United States intelligence community who is mandated to provide the president with this kinds of heads up, and it failed to do so.
And you write,
so even if the president misspoke, that doesn't do away with the fact that there was an intelligence failure.
You write, almost everything the NCMI knew about the current situation in Wuhan came from the World Health Organization. And so you are suggesting that they failed bigly because they didn't conduct their own independent investigations. And do you surmise that they didn't have significant assets in China?
Well, again, I don't know. Well, first of all, the NCM, the National Center for Medical Intelligence, doesn't have assets. They're a small group. They have a division that does viral epidemiology and investigates that, but they task. Their job is to task and then receive information. They task the greater intelligence community, which does have the ability, if they don't have assets in place, to reach out. And I'll give you an example of why this is especially an intelligence failure. In October of 2019, the United States sent 300 military personnel to Wuhan to participate in the international military games. One of the NCMIA's jobs is to prepare the exact same thing they prepared for me as a weapons inspector, sort of an intelligence report on this is the threat that you could be facing in China from infectious diseases. Now, it's not as though China never appeared on the map. We know that H1N1 and other diseases came from China. We know that China is a cesspool of potential viral and epidemics. China's been on our radar for years. And so the question is, in preparing this intelligence report for these 300 military personnel, did they do any predictive work? Did they task the CIA to get into the Wuhan infectious disease center to find out if there's anything going on? Did they send operatives in to take samples from, from Chinese citizens? These are the things that intelligence, agencies do. This is how you fight. This is how you get ahead of pandemics, by going out and doing the intelligence preparation of the battlefield. You don't just sit and wait for this to happen. You go and actively collect the intelligence. Not only that, here you had 300 Americans in the center of Wuhan in October, which we now know starting October 1st, we now know thanks to the Chinese, that coronavirus became active around October 1st. That's when they call it the tree stump of the disease was identified around that time. Did they screen these personnel? Did they take blood samples? Did they do other testing of these personnel to find out if they had been exposed to any of this work? This is the kind of stuff that you should be doing on a regular basis that gives you a heads up as to what could be happening in Wuhan, where we now know we had the first outbreak in late December of 2019.
And we don't have any knowledge that goes deeper than news accounts of exactly what the NCMI did related to these athletic competitions and the presence of 300 American troops in Wuhan.
Well, everything's been classified. Now, some things should be classified. I have to tell you that if they had tasked the CIA's Medical Intelligence Department to get a human asset embedded in Wuhan, we don't need to know that. That's the kind of stuff that remains secret. If they, on the other hand, did a screening of the American service members and something emerged from that point, that's not secret. That's standard medical biological screening that takes place frequently. It shouldn't be classified. It may be treated as medically sensitive, but it should be shared with the Center of Disease Control. And I have a problem with this level of secrecy. To give you an example, sometime in mid-March, the head of the CDC testified before the House Oversight Committee. And he was asked a question by a congressman about could it be possible that instances of influenza, the flu, that were treated and diagnosed as flu, where people died, that could have been COVID-19. And the head of the CDC came back and said, it's not only possible, it did happen. We've gone back and taken a look at several instances where people died who were diagnosed with the flu, and it turns out they died from COVID-19. And then the questioning stopped. And I'm sitting there screaming, whoa, when did this happen? Where did this happen? How many people did this happen? Did you go back and do a contact report based upon, this person, who they could possibly have exposed things to? These are very important questions, and the public's not getting the answer. That doesn't mean that the answer doesn't exist, but you're not exuding competence to a public that desperately needs to know that its officials are doing the right thing.
And Scott, isn't this further complicated because the National Security Council has moved to further classify deliberations in the White House, and this has left out some people who don't have security clearances but do have expertise, for example, in epidemiology. And, this has made it more difficult to achieve any kind of transparency.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in something like this, we need transparency. Let's just be blunt about this. On September 11th of 2001, we had a horrible thing happen to our country. Nearly 3,000 people died. We held a commission, and we suffered billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in economic damage. And this was seen as a shock. We held a commission. We tried to find out if there was an intelligence failure. We determined there was. We tried to find out if there were policy failures. We determined there were. And supposedly means were taken to correct these. Here we have something that, we're already up over the $3 trillion in damage. The number could go even higher. It's wrecked the American economy. More people are going to die from this disease in the United States than on 9/11, and yet everything's wrapped in secrecy. Congress is cut out. This is not the way this country's supposed to work. I don't think we should be doing anything at this point in time to impede the ability of the executive branch to get a grip on this crisis and to, put in place policies that save as many American lives as possible and bring our economy back as soon as possible. But when this is all said and done, all that stuff, Congress needs to take control of the situation. All that stuff needs to be declassified, and we need to find out how this happened so we can ensure it never happened again. If that's my one theme from this, especially to the National Center for Military Intelligence, hey, intelligence failures happen. I was an intelligence officer for many years. I made mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. The key to being a good intelligence officer is when you make a mistake, you sit down and you say, how did this happen and how do I ensure this never happens again? We should be bending over backwards to make sure that never again a virus of this nature comes into being without our getting as much advance notice as possible. If we're simply reading the investigation reports of the Chinese government as published to the World Health Organization, we're not doing our job as intelligence officers.
Well, Scott, I agree with very much of what you just said. I just want to separate myself from your confidence in the 9/11 Commission in particular. They did discover some important things, but they whitewashed a great deal. They suppressed a lot of important testimony. And my level of confidence in these types of commissions is extremely low. That said, it's better than nothing, and we shouldn't have nothing. I'll say that.
Just because, look, I don't have any confidence in it. What I'm saying, I was trying to be a gentleman about this and just say that after 9/11, we deemed that it was a problem of such magnitude that there was this commission.
Agreed.
Whether or not the commission did its job, whether it could have done better, I think everybody agrees that it could have done better and should have done better. But the point is, from a national perspective, we deemed 9/11 to be such a tremendous shock to our nation that we held this commission to find out what had happened and to try and ensure that it never happens again. So we need to be doing that about coronavirus.
In your article, I think you get this just right. You say in relation to the 300 military athletes who went to Wuhan in early October, you reference that China has suggested that these personnel might have introduced the virus infection to Wuhan. And you end that paragraph by noting properly there is no independent evidence to support these allegations. But tell me what you make of a couple of options or possibilities here, scenarios. Number one, China has a robust propaganda operation. They control information and media greater perhaps than any other major nation on Earth. And so I am skeptical of what they're saying. But often propaganda has a kernel of truth to it with a lot of elaboration and hyperbole. So I keep an open mind here and consider that that is a possibility. I would also note that Wuhan is the center of a biological laboratory that could be a development center similar to Fort Detrick. And so I consider that a possible scenario. And I also consider that some of those athletes who got sick and were treated, and in turn China says, and this could be factual, that some number around 24 of the medical personnel who treated those men did test positive later for the coronavirus. I don't know what level of fatalities may have resulted from that. So I'm a person who doesn't promote conspiracy theory, but I focus on blowing up cover-ups. And so with that in mind, I'd just like to ask you what the state is of your current speculation.
And we'll start by that it's pure speculation. I don't pretend to have any special sources of information on this. I'll start out by saying that there is an element of propaganda going on here from China. The most of the, if not all of the accusations about the Americans bringing the virus to Wuhan come from a spokesperson aligned with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And he is largely responding to the continued use by American politicians, including the president, of the term Chinese virus or Wuhan virus.
Right.
And a trend on the part of some politicians like Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, to blame China exclusively for this. And so, China views what's happening here in the United States as anti-Chinese propaganda, and their propaganda apparatus kicks in and starts, fighting back. It doesn't make any of it true.
And let me just enlarge the frame here to include the bitter trade war that has led to a recession in China economic stalls prior to the pandemic originating in Wuhan.
There's no love lost between these two nations right now, between the United States and China, dating back to the trade war. You're absolutely correct. Now, you know, does China have a level four bio safety facility located in Wuhan? Yes. The United States has a level four biosafety facility located in Fort Detrick, Maryland. One of those facilities was shut down for bad safety practices, for leaving the door open and allowing things to leak out. It wasn't a Chinese facility.
Right.
Fort Detrick was shut down in June of last year for these reasons. I don't blame Fort Detrick. It doesn't appear that Fort Detrick was doing anything with COVID-19. We don't know, but there's no reason to believe, again, because it was shut down in June, July, and the Chinese, by reverse engineering COVID, says that the current form of virulent coronavirus that we call COVID-19 came into being sometime around in early October. So I don't believe there's any linkage between Fort Detrick being shut down and the COVID virus. I don't believe the Americans brought COVID virus to China. Forget the Chinese propaganda. Let's talk to the Chinese scientists who have been very, very open and very, very transparent. And they come on their national TV and they say things like, shame on the foreign ministry. They should shut up and keep their nose out of business where it doesn't belong. They say that we don't know where the COVID-19 came from. What they do know is it didn't come from the so-called wet market, you know, where they sell the dogs, the bats, the mm-hmm. cats, and all that. It didn't come from the wet market. We know that. Even Tom Cotton acknowledges it didn't come from the wet market. It came from somewhere, though. And the Chinese say we're doing our best to find out. So when you cut through the propaganda and you get down to the science, the science is where the answers reside, and that's what people should be focused on, the science, the facts, not, you know, the range of emotions that drive the propaganda and drive people's opinions who are fed by propaganda. Right now, there's a huge effort in the United States to blame China for this. Maybe China's to blame. We don't know. But to rush to judgment like this is just simply wrong.
I agree.
We need to find out where it came from, and the one nation that's leading the effort to discover that is China.
There is an issue.
Pretty darn good job.
There is an issue, though. You may be better informed on this than I, but we saw that anecdotally, one of the first doctors in Wuhan who tried to sound the alarm ultimately died. But before that, he was silenced by the central government in Beijing. And so I have been wary myself of the data reported from China, and it's not a knock on their scientists. It's how much that data is being massaged before it reaches the public.
No, I understand, and I've dug into that. The doctor in question was an ophthalmologist, eye doctor. Had no relationship to the investigation, no relationship to the ward where the infections came on. Sometime in late December, he either saw a file or talked to another doctor who discussed a file about a cluster of pneumonias of unknown epidemiology, meaning they didn't know what it was. He didn't know it was coronavirus. He didn't know it was COVID-19. COVID-19 wasn't subtyped until early January. All he knew is that there was a pneumonia cluster. He got on an app, a social app, and he discussed with his families and friends. He said, hey, just be careful. There's this thing going on here, et cetera. In the United States, we call that a HIPAA violation. In the United States, we would censor, we would punish any doctor who started acting on rumor. And the Chinese did the exact same thing. They called him in. They said, what are you doing? Why are you spreading these rumors? We have an investigation body that's ongoing. Let them do their job. Don't get out ahead of it. Don't create panic mongering. We simply don't know what's going on here. Don't create a panic. He was wrong, 100% wrong. Now, it turns out, in retrospect, that there was a coronavirus, and it was very, it was readily spread. And the Chinese government came back, and they said, hey, maybe we're a little harsh on you, but you still violated the rules. You violated the procedures, which he did. He subsequently was returned to work, where he was exposed to the virus, tragically died. But this isn't a case of the Chinese trying to, you know, manipulate facts or the Chinese trying to suppress. We had a case of an ophthalmologist going out of school to report on things he clearly wasn't positioned to report on properly. He wasn't an epidemiologist. He wasn't a viral specialist. He was an eye doctor who had serendipitously come in contact with reports about people getting pneumonia. This was before it became typecast as COVID-19. And for people to say that he was blowing the whistle on coronavirus and he was suppressed by the Chinese is just factually wrong.
All right. Thank you. As you're describing that, I'm thinking of an ophthalmologist who serves in the United States Senate who was quite dismissive of the virus until he tested positive on the very day that the Senate was in session on a Sunday to take up the initial Republican package in the what I consider to be the bailout and stimulus package, and that would be Senator Rand Paul.
Karma is a strange thing. I say the same thing about Boris Johnson.
You can say bitch. No. You can say bitch. We're on a podcast.
It's karma has a way of coming back and biting you. And I hope Rand Paul recovers. I hope Boris Johnson recovers. But the people that dismissed this out of hand called it a hoax. Look, I still don't know if the answer was to shut down the government or not, or shut down the economy or not. I don't know. I know the decision was made. I support the decision, and I will do everything. But this is one of the things that we need to find out after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
What were we dealing with, and why were the measures we took appropriate? That doesn't mean that the people that took the measures are wrong. When you're in an unknown situation, you have to decide. And sometimes the decisions you make aren't necessarily the best decisions, but you have to make a decision.
Indeed.
At some point down the road, we need to find out what exactly happens here.
Well, and this is what is often referred to as a Hobson's choice, that if you do nothing, you feel that you unnecessarily risked excess deaths in this country. And if you do too much, you can be criticized. But at this point, I agree with you. It's not the proper moment to back off from the response in order to try to sort it out and blame people. I want to turn next to a piece that you wrote analyzing the economic impact. The headline reads, COVID-19 has exposed just how broken the American economy and society are, and you argue a $2 trillion package alone won't fix it. So let me quote a little bit. The coronavirus pandemic has exposed some uncomfortable truths about the state of America today. First and foremost is the fragility of the economy. After years of outsourcing manufacturing, the U.S. has constructed an economy where service industries comprise some 55% of overall economic activity. And in this age of globalization with interconnectivity, this model has been able to generate the appearance of prosperity with a booming stock market and increased gross domestic product. You continue. The reality, however, is that the American economy lacks resilience in time of crisis. And let me interject, Scott, that I think that's aggravated by the combination of the 2017 tax cuts, which were mostly focused on corporations, and the almost zero interest rates that we have returned to today. And my point in saying that is we have only the prospect of what has happened, which is to borrow at this point. I argue that part of the McConnell package should have been a full rollback of those 2017 tax cuts as a down payment on the bailout of the same corporations who took those tax cuts. And I'm focused on American Airlines with this comment. They spent 95% of it on stock buybacks, which enhances the pay of executives primarily. And they also, American, incurred a huge debt load buying new aircraft in the same period of time. And to bail them out for their bad judgment is a tough one for me. Let me return to quoting you. The ongoing trade war with China combined with a depressed global oil market, and we're going to touch on that a little later, we're in the process of exposing this reality before the pandemic. The national lockdown and resulting economic stoppage only accelerated what was a gradual economic recession in progress. So I think these are spot-on comments, Scott, and it's sad to me to see that there's so little reflection of this point of view in corporate media punditry.
No, it's I agree with you. Yeah, it's almost as if you say these things, you're somehow unpatriotic because, you know, we're quote-unquote a nation at war today and, you know, we're on a wartime footing and everybody has to. But the fact of the matter is, if we're a nation at war, then we need to do a careful assessment of just how vulnerable we are. You know, we may emerge from this war intact, we will, but we're going to be weakened because the fantasy world that we were living in has been exposed to be just that, a fantasy. To give you an example, you know, there's this big debate about health care. You know, do we have Medicaid for all? Do we continue with the modification of the Obama health care plan? Or do you know, we go the Republican route, which cancel it all and let the free market take care of it? But the bottom line is we keep talking about the American health care system. We have the greatest healthcare system in the world. No, we don't. We have the most dysfunctional healthcare system in the world, and the proof is in how we're responding to this pandemic. We might have good healthcare facilities. We might have good healthcare practitioners who populate healthcare hotspots throughout the country where people who can afford healthcare get the healthcare, and it's the best in the world. But a system implies that, you know, systemically across the breadth and width of the United States, this level of health care is available to the average American, and it is not. I'm telling you, as the father of two daughters who have entered the workforce and no longer can be on our health care, sitting down with them and coming, you know, and addressing the reality that they got to take their meager, you know, earnings, and after they pay taxes, after they pay, you know, their rent, after they pay their utilities, and they're looking at what's left for them to live after they pay their college loans, they sit down and say, okay, well, we can live on this. No, you can't, because you have one more thing you have to pay for, health insurance. And when they, you know, then you look at the fact that either they pay $200 a month to, you know, but that buys you into a package where you have to have $7,000 in cash available in case you get really ill, because that's what your deductible is, or you have to pay $500 a month, which they can't afford because once they pay that, they got nothing left. That's not a healthcare system. That's highway robbery. That has most of our people avoiding buying the expensive insurance, going for the lesser insurance. And then when you have a pandemic come, they can't afford treatment. And, you know, now we have politicians understanding that, hey, you know, we have to get mandatory testing to bring this thing under control. So, but if we required the testing to be covered by insurance, nobody would get tested because they can't afford it. So suddenly they say, well, my God, we got to pay for this. The country's got to pay for this. We guess we got to pay for the treatment, too. But that's the reality of every illness, every disease for most Americans. They can't afford it. And we've just exposed the lie of the American healthcare system, you know, to our politicians. What's going to be done about that? We've exposed the lie, as you point out. It's not just American Airlines. It's the entire corporate body in America today. They exist to put money in the pockets of their shareholders. That's their sole purpose for existing. They don't exist to become strong, resilient companies. If they were, they'd have a rainy day fund because, you know, bad things happen. There are economic turndowns, and the smart companies say we need to have the ability to ride out a turndown so that we emerge stronger. That's a smart company. We don't have smart companies in America today. We have greedy companies, companies that look out for the shareholder at the expense of the worker. And the workers are now out in the street getting, what, $1,200?
In an advance. It's recoverable, yeah, if you don't qualify for the tax credit.
So it's a loan. They're probably going to charge interest. I'll get to that in a second. But, you know,
well, so, Scott, let me pause for a moment here.
$17 a day is what it rates down to. That's what Mnuchin says, that Americans have to learn to live on $17 a day.
Scott, I don't want to project my politics on you. My supposition is you're a fair degree more conservative than I am. But what you just described, and your ire is quite appropriate, to me, is the Bernie Sanders agenda. Because we have, you know, in a social democratic way, the Congress last week pumped $2+ trillion in cash, plus the multiplier of about $4 trillion that will be doled out by the Fed, and it is socialism. It's corporate welfare. There's a little bit. I did a rough calculation, and there's about $1 trillion for human beings, and the rest of it, $5+, is aimed at propping up the economy and bailing out corporations that were on a path to failure before this. And then we see that, you know, Medicare for All, which has been derided even by, you know, all the moderate Democrats through the debates. We saw each time there was somebody tagged with slamming Bernie for the socialist tag on Medicare for All. But what we have right
now, how do you pay for it?
right now, we have a short-term Medicare for All. It's linked to, you know, the COVID pandemic. But that's exactly what it is. The bill also includes relief for student loans. It's a corporate tax credit for companies that pay $5,000 a year plus of their employees' student loans. And so, I just see this as so remarkable. And here's where, you know, I'm not blaming Trump for any of this. This is the fol-de-rol in the Democratic Party, where they are so fearful, and it drew the boomers out for the miraculous Lazarus-like resuscitation of Joe Biden's campaign. And they're so afraid of Bernie. And I have to tag African Americans, because the sweep in the South that gave a huge delegate boost to Biden is once again based on Bernie's fear of Bernie Sanders that has been ginned up by the people who run the Democratic Party and the media outlets that support their gatekeeper role in trying to keep Bernie Sanders out of the White House at all costs. And I just find it deeply ironic and even more tragic that what we have seen here in this response is exactly in line with the Sanders agenda.
Look, I we're not that far apart. I supported Sanders in 2016, and I'm a fan of Bernie Sanders today. I find it very, very troubling that, you know, as you said, the Congress and the president have embraced a perversion of the Sanders solution, because it's, you know, even though it's socialism, it's not. I think Bernie Sanders would have allocated these resources with a different weighting in mind, one that looked more after the people than the corporations. But, you know, one of the things that always came up in those debates, you know, from Joe Biden and others, you know, how are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for it? Well, the exact same way you just paid for all this crap. You, excuse my language, you invent the money. You get the Fed to toggle a couple computer switches, and suddenly trillions of dollars appear in banks across the country. It's fake money. We've been doing it for years. We just proved that we can generate fake money to pay for things, you know, because we have a fake economy. We have a fake healthcare system. Everything about America, it turns out, is fake. It's this gigantic bubble of opulence that rests on nothing. Imaginary money, imaginary profits. When you can have a market in 5 minutes erase $1.3 trillion of our gross national product, that's fake. That means that money didn't really exist. It wasn't wedded to anything other than, you know, a ledger. So I just find it a shame that the one man who could manage this problem effectively, because it's exactly his, you know, it's in his bailiwick, it's socialism, has been sidelined. And instead we have, you know, this you know, capitalist greed in the executive department, and we have these Democrats who are and Republicans who hate socialism in Congress playing games that they don't understand. They don't know what they're doing, and they're just further bankrupting the nation. The people are the people aren't being helped by this stimulus or this bailout. And frankly speaking, many of the corporations aren't going to be helped. I hazard to say that if we continue this shutdown for much longer, when we try to revive the economy, there's going to be a lot of dead corporate bodies on the side of the road.
Well, and Trump's blue sky bullshit that is detected by so many Americans, you know, when he goes on TV for these narcissist-feeding daily briefings, it is often led to, you know, 3-5% daily drops in the value of the Dow. And your point is correct that it's all, you know, propped up and inflated and fake. But it is the only rubric that we have. And
it's linked to retirement plans of so many of these Americans.
Well, I'm going
to
retire.
My wife in her 401k.
Well, Scott, I'm going to retire later this year. And, you know, my portfolio, meager as it is, has been hammered, you know, by roughly 20%. It goes up and
Absolutely.
Down. But it's a little scary because in February I was feeling prosperous and looking forward to a comfortable retirement. And,
yeah,
you know,
and it's changed your plans.
I'm not entirely dependent on the stock market, but to the extent that I am, it's put a big hole in my nest egg.
I have friends, my wife, and it's the same story, you know. I mean, we still got, you know, a little bit of time left before we retire, but not that much time. And it's disconcerting to take a look at, you know, what you were looking at, thought was a nice, healthy, nest egg and realize that the yolk's been dripping out for a while.
Yeah, exactly. Scott, I want to move on to the oil wars and an excellent piece that you wrote, but it seemed like you had one or two more things you wanted to add about the economy.
No, look, I'm not an economist. I'm just a concerned American citizen who sits back and looks at this from a distance. But, you know, I just think that, you know, as we move forward as a nation in a post-coronavirus world, some realities have to come home. One, you know, globalization as it's currently structured does not work for the American worker. You know, we need to bring we need to bring production means back home, whether it's in the United States or closer to the United States. This is not China's fault. I give China nothing but kudos for what they've done. I mean, three consecutive five-year plans where they pulled 300 million people out of poverty into the middle class. My God, that's amazing. Kudos to you.
That's what Joe clobbered Bernie with in the last debate. He pivoted from remarks that Bernie made decades ago about Fidel Castro improving living conditions and the quality of education and health care in Cuba. And then Joe just went right to, you know, you've praised China.
Well, I'm praising China right now. I'm telling you that China has done a great job. But, you know, I'm an American. I'm not Chinese. I don't care if the Chinese government does a good job for the Chinese people. What I care about, and I'm not talking about the Uyghurs. I'm not talking about human rights. I'm saying that, you know, they pulled 300 people out of poverty.
300 million.
And they brought them into middle class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when we look at the United States, you know, we in order to make that happen, we had to ship a lot of our manufacturing overseas to allow China to do this. And we're now in a situation where we have no resilience. I mean, where our drugs come from? Where do the small parts come from? Where do the things that make Walmart tick come from? Where's this all come from? From China. And what we've learned is when you have a global shutdown, when you have a trade war, we suddenly have a problem as a country. I'd like to, you know, see future generations of politicians take a look at economic structuring that I'm not talking about being an isolationist, but, you know, we have a duty and responsibility to look out for the American worker,
mm-hmm.
For the American citizen. And we need to bring these jobs home. And if we don't bring them inside our borders, you know what? Rather than have a factory in Wuhan, why not a factory in Guatemala? Why not raise the living standards in Guatemala to the point that they don't feel the necessity to come up north? Why not build factories in El Salvador, build factories in Mexico if we need cheap labor to make the American economy? You know, there's just got to be alternatives to what we're doing because this current plan doesn't work. It's broken. And we just proved how broken it is. And what are we going to do at the end of the coronavirus crisis? Are we going to go back to, you know, life is normal, life as usual, which is what Trump implies we're going to do? Then that means we haven't learned anything from this crisis.
And again, Trump had played this Easter Bunny fantasy, right? That we could yeah. restart the economy just after
Easter, yeah.
we all go to church on Easter. Well, if he really wants to make a significant effort to stimulate the global economy in a way that would benefit the United States, he would announce that he is going to suspend all of the tariffs on Chinese trade at least for a period of time. And if he gets reelected, he could reevaluate that and return to bully mode. But I think that it's in our best interest to stop the trade
Absolutely.
Wars and to,
Absolutely.
You know, return Absolutely. To the status quo ante simply out of self-interest.
Absolutely. I this trade war is stupid. It doesn't lead to a solution. It only creates more problems. And I'll leave it with this. You know, there's something I saw, a nice clip on the internet of Putin, you know, you appropriately hiss and boo right now because I'm talking about the personification of evil. But he, in response to the national response to coronavirus, was upset that Russian industrialists were slow to respond to his demands for products. So he went down there. He convened a meeting, brought them all around the table, sat down with them, and he chewed them out. He said, thousands of lives are at stake here. And I'm telling you right now, if you can't do it, I'll dissolve your corporations today. I'll take them over and I'll find somebody who can do it. You're going to sign this agreement. And he made every single one of these billionaires sign an agreement to do what was required. Now, yeah, we can't necessarily do that in the United States, but you know what? That's leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the president pretends to be a leader, but when he gets in a room with these corporate heads, they own them. They simply sit there, and all you have to do to make this president happy is blow smoke up his butt, make him feel like he's 10 feet tall, and the next thing you know, he's giving you trillions of dollars of tax-free bailout. And it is that. I'll leave it on this one. We give the banks free money, and then the banks turn around and loan it to me at an exorbitant interest rate. Why don't I get free money? Why do the banks get to live off of, you know, the Fed? They didn't earn that money. They were given it to them by the American government, by the government that's paid for by my taxes. And then they turn around and they charge me, you know, whatever interest rate they feel is optimal for the day that has no relationship to the interest rate the government charges them. It's purely profit on their end. That's not how you stimulate economy. That's how you drive Americans further into debt.
Well, and that free money that you just described has not caused any reduction in credit card interest rates. They are profiteering like bandits. And this is a time when people need more access to credit. And, we should be seeing a 50% reduction across the board in credit card rates.
This is where we need Vladimir Trump to call all the bankers together into a room and tell them that I'm just going to shut down your banks. I'm going to shut you all down. The way I'm going to shut you down is you get no more money from me. I'm going to set up my own national bank, and I'm going to lend money to the American worker at low interest rates because you guys are obviously not looking out for the benefit of the workers. This is the kind of leadership we need today. Instead, you know, we have an executive and a Congress held hostage to, you know, corporate interests, and the average American pays a price. And, yeah, I know I'm sounding more and more like a socialist and not like a Ronald Reagan Republican, but times, they are a-changing.
Scott, I want to turn to a powerful piece that you published, I think it's about 10 days ago now, at the American Conservative. And you give a brief on the shift in oil markets and the battle between Russia and Saudi Arabia. And you properly say that Russia is essentially hurting Saudi Arabia, but the main target is the shale oil and fracking product that has made the United States the world's largest oil exporter. And I want to give you like 5 minutes here, if you could, to sum up the analysis that you offer. And I'm just going to trigger it by saying that today, crude oil from the U.S. is hitting about 20, at some points trading $19 a barrel. And the Brent crude quote is 26. And there are few economies that can survive on these crude oil prices. And there are predictions that it could go as low as $10 in the near future. So that's my setup. You go.
Well, we'll start with some realities. It costs the Saudis about $8, $9 a barrel to produce oil. So clearly, they make a little bit of money at $20 a barrel. It costs the Russians around $20 a barrel to make. It can go lower in some cases, $15 to make a barrel of oil. It costs the United States between $40 and $60 to pump out a barrel of oil. So if you're selling oil at $20 a barrel. You know, right off the bat, the American oil producers are losing anywhere from $20 to $40 per barrel. And when you're shipping out, you know, millions of barrels a day, you know, that becomes real money real quick. But now let's go to Saudi Arabia. Well, they may be able to produce oil. Their budget to do the growth, to do the domestic programs they want, et cetera, requires oil to be sold at between $60 and $80. A barrel. So they're rapidly going bankrupt because they aren't raising the capital needed, the income needed to pay for their domestic programs, to pay for their military, to pay for anything. They have a $500 billion slush fund. That's going to be gone tomorrow. Not tomorrow, but, you know, in the blink of an eye. The one nation that's prepared for this is Russia. They have no debt. They've built up a war chest. Their currency is not linked to the dollar, so it can float and give them the ability to absorb, changes in oil pricing, et cetera. They can offset their losses through taxation of state-owned companies, so it becomes a ledger game. Russia says we can ride this thing out for 6 to 10 years. Saudi Arabia can't ride this out for 6 to 10 years. They're going to be bankrupt in two. The United States can't ride this out for a year. We had a similar oil war in 2014. Saudi Arabia backed down at that point in time. But in order for the U.S. fracking industry to survive, they had to borrow a lot of money. They had to have a lot of capital injected into them. They've gone deeply in debt, and they haven't paid that debt off. So they're over-leveraged, and they're going to be shutting down. And it's bad for the workers involved. It's bad for the economy. But the reality is that the American fracking industry cannot survive a long-term price war. Now, why is this price war taking place? There's two aspects to it. One, Saudi Arabia needed the price of oil to go up. And so they've encouraged Russia to join OPEC, the Associated Oil Producing Nations, to reduce the amount of oil that they produce. And by reducing the amount of oil available to the market, the price of oil can be either maintained steady or even rise. And that brings more money for them per barrel sold. The United States, on the other hand, isn't reducing. We're going full-fledged. We're fracking everything. You know, Trump is bragging about how we've become the number one producer of oil in the world. We're exporting oil. All of this is true. But we're doing it to the expense of Saudi Arabia. We're doing it at the expense of Russia. We have a policy of economic sanction against nations like Iran and Venezuela that prevent these major oil-producing nations from shipping oil. Who has stepped in and filled this void? Not Saudi Arabia, not Russia. The United States. So there's a lot of resentment on the part of Saudi Arabia and Russia to the United States for seizing international market share by sanctioning nations and by overproducing oil through fracking. Now, Russia, they're mature. They were willing to shrug this off until the United States started sanctioning their oil industry. This was a bridge too far, because the last thing Russia is going to do is reduce its oil production to help Saudi Arabia's economy, while at the same time freeing up global market share for the United States to exploit. So Russia said, no, we're not going to do that. We're actually going to increase the amount of oil. And they triggered this war. The Saudis responded by saying, well, we can always, produce more oil than you, and the lower prices, you'll be driven out before we'll be driven out. That's not true. Saudi Arabia is going to blink long before the Russians blink. The nation that's going to pay the price is the United States. And one of the reasons why Russia picked this time for this is that because of the coronavirus, we're in a global economic halt where the demand for energy has been reduced. So how do you make oil prices go low? You produce more oil. How do you make it go even lower? Produce a lot more oil when nobody needs it. There is an oil glut in the world today. It's only going to get worse as Russia and Saudi Arabia continue to produce. And these, you know, the president has tried to buy some time by using these low oil prices to fill up the national strategic reserve. But when that's done and there's no more, you know, empty spaces for us to pump oil into, we got to shut the wells down. And when you shut them down, many of these wells aren't starting back up. And it's going to be a heavy blow to the American fracking industry, to international oil companies. And the country that's going to come out of this the strongest is Russia. They're well positioned to come out of this stronger than anybody. Saudi Arabia, this may trigger the kind of economic recession that causes governments to fall. So this could be the end of Saudi Arabia, the end of the American fracking industry, and the emergence of Russia as perhaps the global energy dominant power.
Scott, that is a brilliant description of what is going on right now, and I really appreciate that analysis. I underscore what you're saying about the glut. I believe that last week there was a report that the storage capacity worldwide is maxing out right now. And I'll just add that fracking shows diminishing returns over time, particularly in the early natural gas fields in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Fracking has a big burst initially, but it does taper off, and we are hitting that point. But I want to focus just on one other issue, and that is you and I are both deeply skeptical of the Russiagate narrative that was promoted as the reason that Hillary lost. And I still remain weirded out by the way Trump has tried to befriend and stroke Vladimir Putin. And it seems like Putin is the adult in the room here, and he was willing to indulge Trump as long as he thought that it might lead to a lifting of U.S. sanctions against Russia and some sort of normalization of relations. But the Congress has thwarted that, and despite whatever the weirdness is between Trump and Putin, it appears that's over.
Yeah, it's. Putin is an adult, unlike the child man that populates the White House. Putin is an adult. He's not a perfect adult. He has his negatives, especially if you're an American who has an appreciation for human rights. You might find much wanting in this man. He has a foreign minister named Sergei Lavrov, who is the consummate diplomat, another adult. These are people who don't allow grudges, who don't allow personal animosities to drive their decisions. They make decisions purely on the basis of what's good for their nation. And Putin was willing to work with Donald Trump, who indicated in his lead-up to being elected in 2016 that he wanted to have improved relations with Russia. Russia feels very wronged by what happened in 2014. They feel that the United States has misrepresented the truth about what happened in Ukraine. They have misrepresented the reality of Crimea. That's a discussion to have in another day. But Russia feels wrong. They feel that the sanctions that were imposed on them were counterproductive and that Donald Trump would reverse that and allow Russia to be brought back into the family of nations to work productively with Europe and the United States for their mutual benefit. And they were willing to pay a price to wait out as to see if Trump could emerge politically victorious against a Congress that was dead set against any improvement in relations. As you pointed out, Trump has not been able to achieve this, and Russia's patience is worn out. You don't see Vladimir Putin getting on TV calling Donald Trump the personification of evil and calling them names, et cetera. They're just implementing policies that are cold-hearted and are going to end up helping Russia at the expense of the United States. And one of the major policies that they're doing right now is this price war with Saudi Arabia.
Well, Scott, I want to thank you. This has been a long interview, but people have time these days to listen to long podcasts, and I've actually tested with my listeners, and they're giving me that feedback. So thank you for an excellent conversation on your recent articles. I want to close just with a quick question to you. I often take your articles and post them on Facebook, and I get pushback when people see, ooh, it's from RT. That is a Russia propaganda outlet. And, you know, I look at the individual publications and some of the video reports that appear on RT, and I don't regularly go to their website. I don't even know what cable channel they're on, if they're on my cable system. But my point is, I trust Scott Ritter. And wherever your byline shows up, whether it's at the American Conservative or at RT, I consider that to be credible. And yet so many people have now been trained to hate Russia, to fear it, and they believe that RT is this insidious arm of the Russian government. And I accept that RT does amplify coverage that is critical of the United States. But that doesn't make the criticism wrong, and particularly when the material is generated by Americans who I have confidence in, I just don't care that it's on RT. Explain to people what your options are to get your material published and why you sometimes publish at RT.
Well, it comes down to two things. One is the reality of earning a living as a writer. You can't earn a living as a writer if people aren't willing to pay you for your output. And there are limited venues for the kind of geopolitical product that I put out there. I've been very fortunate to have a great relationship with the American Conservative. And one thing I'll say about the American Conservative is there is zero editorial direction, meaning and that doesn't mean that they don't have editors that do quality control and all that. But I will write with a pitch. I will say, hey, this is something that's happening. This is the angle I want to do. They'll either come back and say yes, or they'll come back and say, we're going to pass on that. But there's no effort to say, oh, no, you got to change it for us to publish. It's either a yes or no quotient. And fortunately for me, they've said yes far more times than they said no. Until they closed, shut down, I had a good relationship with Truthdig, which is a progressive outlet. And I was able to get, pieces published there. And again, this the same thing. You put a pitch forward, they either say yes or they say no. There's no effort to control. I have a nice relationship with Joe Lurie at Consortium News. I don't publish there as often as I'd like, but again, I've come forward. They accept it. They let me write what I want to write, and they publish it. I was approached by RT in December, and they said, "Would you like to write some stuff? We've been reading your stuff, and we find it interesting." And I said, "Well, look, I'm always looking for outlets. I would be more than happy to do this, but you understand, I write what I write. I don't write for you. I don't write for the brand. I don't I will." Say, I'd like to write this. This is the angle. And you either publish it or you don't. RT accepted that. So as far as I'm concerned, RT has not sought to influence what I write in any way, shape, or form. By getting my word out in RT, I've basically quadrupled the amount of articles I can write in a month. And for me, not only is that good from a an income generation standpoint, but it's If your goal as a writer is to influence people, to put knowledge and information out there so people can be better informed, so they can engage in a broader discussion of very complex issues, that's manna from heaven. So people, rather than looking at the source of it, because I'm sure there's a lot of progressives that look at the American Conservative and say, oh my God, it's a conservative. A lot of conservatives that looked at Truthdig and said, oh my God, I used to write for the Huffington Post. There's some people who will never read the Huffington Post. I've been approached by Fox News to write for them. I won't do that. That's a decision I made. Some people said, go to CNN. I won't do that either, because both of those outlets have extreme levels of editorial control where they shape the content you seek to publish. I won't write for anybody who seeks to shape what I write. RT publishes my my material. I'm grateful for them to do so, but it's my material. It's not RT's material. And to date, I have yet to have RT say no to a proposal that I've put forward.
Well, Lee Camp, the comic reporter who has a weekly video show on RT, I talked to him sometime last year. And tongue-in-cheek, I asked him, you know, exactly how Putin approves the work that he does. And he had a very funny response, and I'll just leave it at that. People can go to my website, put Lee Camp in the search window, and it's one of the opening questions, and it'll, I hope, generate a laugh. Well, Scott, thank you very much for joining us today. I really enjoyed this conversation, and as always, I learn a lot from you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And stay safe.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth extended conversation with Scott Ritter. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.